Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Media in the studios of KAKM.
Hello, and welcome to Alaska Edition. I'm your host, Zachariah Hughes. Today, we'll be discussing the legalization of marijuana coming up next Tuesday and what it means for state residents in real terms. We'll also bring you a report from the Alaska Public Radio Network's Alexandra Gutierrez on a rare visit from Interior Secretary Sally Jewell to Kotzebue in the Northwest Arctic Borough and the large group of lawmakers who were also in the Arctic. But before that, our guests will be breaking down the first step of implementing Ballot Measure 2. Decriminalization in Alaska hardly means there are no more rules when it comes to recreational marijuana. With us is Bruce Schulte, spokesman for the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation, which supported Ballot Measure 2 last fall. He is now advising legislators as the state works to adapt the will of voters into law. Welcome, Mr. Schulte.
Thanks, Zach.
And we're also joined by Jennifer Castro with the Anchorage Police Department, which has been proactive in preparing for the changing laws to get officers ready, and along with residents of Alaska's largest city. Welcome, Ms. Castro, and I want to start by asking you about the release the department just put out on the Know Your Grow. Can you explain what that is, please?
Absolutely. So we were thinking of a way that we could reach citizens and talk to them about what they can and cannot do. Obviously, there's kind of a lot of gray stuff that's left out there for people. So we created the Know Your Grow campaign, and people can go to muni.org/knowyourgrow, and all the information about what's in current place and procedure for what you can and cannot do with marijuana for as far as your personal use goes, that information is there. And then as ordinances or laws come into play, we'll be updating that website with that information so that people will know what's coming into effect and updating people as those things come into play.
And let me ask you, on Tuesday, what are the rules regarding public consumption?
Sure.
This has been much talked about.
Absolutely.
And maybe we could start with just what you guys define as public.
Right. So, you know, the thing that people need to think of is Tuesday is about personal use. This isn't addressing the sale or commercialization of marijuana. That's obviously going to come at a little bit of a later time, and state lawmakers and a bunch of leaders are working on that right now. So as far as personal use goes, on February 24th, you have to be, the big thing is 21. You have to be 21 years of age in order to possess or use marijuana. You can have up to 1 ounce of marijuana that you are able to possess or share. And you can have 6 plants in your home. 3 of those can be immature and 3 of those can be mature. So kind of the difference there is budding or not budding, in, you know, ones that you can use or ones that are growing. And then the other part of, and that's per household. So that's really important too. So you shouldn't go get an extra roommate just so that you think you can potentially be growing more pot. It's per household at this time. And the big thing though is that you cannot use marijuana in public. And on January 27th, the Anchorage Assembly passed an ordinance to further define what that means. But just think of any public place or dwelling. And there is some rules in there too. Like if you're private property, let's say you're outside on your deck and that's adjacent to like a public use park, and you're smoking marijuana outside, that could be considered potentially a public place. So again, kind of one of those gray areas. So that's where you'd want to be inside of your home to use or possess marijuana at that point in time. So if you go to the muni.org/knowyourgrow website, it has the list of how they further defined out what a public place or space is for that.
Well, and I want to go to you, Mr. Schulte, mm-hmm. because you've testified before the legislature mm-hmm. on Senate Bill 30, which is the bill dealing with this.
Right.
And is there a definition of public there? And can you tell us a little bit about where the legislature is at in terms of drafting comprehensive legislation?
Sure. That has been a point of discussion. And I think there's extremes of, you know, what is private and what is public. I think we could all agree on sort of, you know, what those are. If you look at the alcohol industry, though, there are places where you can consume alcohol on the property of private businesses, but those businesses are licensed to allow that sort of activity. And so, looking forward, we would hope that there might be some opportunity for that kind of thing on the marijuana side, but it's not available yet. That's probably a year down the road. You know, we would like to have that opportunity for certain types of events, and certain locations, but right now we're not seeing that.
And that is something important to point out for now, because, for instance, if I'm a renter, we have a lot of renters in the Anchorage area, it's up to my property owner to determine whether or not I can use marijuana on their property. So whoever is the true property owner of that private property can ultimately say yay or nay to whether or not they want to allow weed or possession or use on their property. So if you're a renter, you probably want to check with your landlord to see what their take is on it.
Interesting. Yeah. And Mr. Schulte, I want to follow that up and just ask, mm-hmm. To people who may be a little bit frustrated by what could seem an incremental or piecemeal approach yeah. to full legalization, mm-hmm. how would you respond to that?
You know, I hear that a lot. A lot of folks say, well, you know, we voted for this thing, it's legal now, why isn't it happening? And I understand their frustration, but in fact, it is happening. And I've sort of begun viewing this in phases. You know, up to the election was phase one. We're sort of in phase two now, which was bringing criminal statutes into line with this voter initiative. That was a huge undertaking, and that's why Senate Bill 30 ended up being an 88-page document, because there's a lot of stuff that has to be realigned and recalibrated, because things that are illegal today won't be in a week. So that's sort of the second phase. And the next phase is the rulemaking process. That's the nine-month window during which a designated board is going to decide the rules under which legitimate marijuana businesses will operate. And that's huge. That's the next phase, and that's going to take the next 9 months to implement. And you know, so we're not expecting permit applications to start coming in for a full year from now.
And it can be a little bit confusing, because uh-huh. there's state legislation being drafted
right.
while municipalities are drafting their own ordinances. And mm-hmm. Ms. Castro, I wonder if you can tell me about what the fine schedule is going to be, or the ticket schedule for
sure.
police.
So currently, right now today, if I was to be smoking a joint in downtown Anchorage, let's say, and I get caught and an officer cites me, it would be a criminal offense. So what's going to happen as of next Tuesday is it's no longer going to be a criminal offense. It's just considered a violation, and then you get written a $100 ticket. We were kind of discussing a little bit this morning at the police department. One of the questions is does that lead up to potentially, sometimes if you keep stacking violations or things, does that lead into something bigger? At this point in time, no. If you get 20 tickets, you have 20 tickets and about $2,000 worth of fines to pay. So that's kind of where they're at with that in terms of what people can do in the municipality. So it's just a civil fine at this time for $100. And I think there's like a $10 surcharge that they charge. So it's $110 total.
Mm. And you mentioned smoking a joint, and that's kind of what I feel like a lot of the example that's offered is. But the legislature, and I can say also the municipality of Anchorage, or the assembly at least, have been vexed by this question of edibles, which mm-hmm. some people may not know very much about. How will the police be responding to consumption that's not obviously marijuana? It doesn't smell like marijuana, it doesn't look like marijuana. I assume beat cops don't want to be stopping everybody they see right. eating a brownie out on the street.
The thing that it really is determined in that basis is obviously each situation is different. But it's I think the challenge for us in some of these cases is going to be to determine how much marijuana does that person have. Obviously, you can have up to an ounce. So looking at a brownie, sometimes it's hard to tell or determine how much is in that brownie. And I think it will take a little bit of further investigation to determine, does this person have the right amount or not? And so some of those cases will be a little bit trickier to look at, but also possibly to prosecute if it comes down to that. So we could see some challenges with that. But at this time, kind of basically what officers have been instructed to do is just they've all been gearing up on how do you look at something as an ounce or not an ounce, and how much product they have. And if it's very clear that they have something way beyond an ounce, then obviously that's going to be taken and seized, because that's not legal of what you're able to have at this point.
And on that question of an ounce, mm-hmm. Bruce, I heard you testifying to the Senate, to the Joint Judiciary Committee mm-hmm. earlier about this question of what is an ounce of usable marijuana
right.
going forward. Is that raw plant material, or with extracted edibles mm-hmm. and concentrates? Is it different? Does the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation have a stance on?
We do, and our position is that the ballot initiative was clear in defining possession of 1 ounce could include marijuana or one of its concentrated forms, so marijuana, hash oil. They are obviously different products, but we feel that the initiative was sufficiently clear that those, you know, 1 ounce, possession of 1 ounce of any one of those would be within the scope of that, the voter initiative. And that has been a subject of discussion. And, you know, some people were concerned, well, you know, 1 ounce of hash oil is different than 1 ounce of flour. And that is an accurate statement, but, you know, the counter argument is, you know, many of us have, you know, several bottles of wine or bottles of hard liquor in our homes. It doesn't mean that they're, you know, they're all going to be consumed at once, or that we should not be allowed to have them in our home. So, yeah, so our position is pretty clear that, you know, we think that 1 ounce is 1 ounce, regardless of the form of the product.
And is there a dose standard for marijuana right now, similar to proof for alcohol?
Not yet. There has been discussion about having limits on the amount of THC that can be infused into edible products, and, you know, whether that, you know, is chocolate or, you know, the ubiquitous brownie or a drink. Colorado has standards like that, and there has been discussion about doing that in Alaska. We support that. What the exact number is going to be remains to be seen.
Another number that I think people may be curious about is legal driving and impairment while driving. Does APD have a set of protocols in place for, I guess, checking someone's level of impairment? And is there anything similar to a, you know, the 0.08 for blood alcohol level?
Right, so what we're obviously talking about is a presumptive level. And right now there hasn't been a presumptive level set in the state of Alaska for impaired driving under marijuana. We've seen some other states set that level. I think in Colorado they have even a sliding presumptive level where if you have marijuana and alcohol combined, those numbers can change up and down. So we're certainly looking at that and seeing how it's working out for other law enforcement. But when it comes to OUI impairment, whether you're impaired under marijuana or any kind of prescription medicine, any kind of possible drug, I don't think the process is really going to change much for that as of February 24th, because you can even be charged with an OUI now being under the 0.08 for alcohol. It's really about when you are pulled over, to what level of impairment you're showing. And through our DUI detection efforts, through the standard field sobriety tests, a lot of the behavior, the processes, and the patterns that they look for at that time is what is really reliant on in terms of the prosecution. So currently how it works, if you have visible signs of impaired driving or an officer has probable cause to pull you over, and it's very clear that there's something that's causing an issue with your driving, the officer asks you to step out of the vehicle. They conduct standard field sobriety tests. They do their evaluations. And if you are obviously impaired at that point in time, they will charge you, arrest you, and take you down to the Anchorage jail. At that point, you provide a breath sample. And if your breath sample shows 0.00, but there's just still a bunch of founded evidence that shows that you are impaired behind the wheel, they will either ask for consent or get a search warrant for your blood. And then they'll do the blood test, and then the blood test will measure the THC level that's in your system. And then they move from there, obviously, based on those results in terms of what gets out in court. And so we also have DRE drug certified. There are a few officers that have this certification, were drug recognition experts, where they can come out, an officer can call them out to the scene and say, hey, I've got so-and-so here, and I don't smell any alcohol in their breath, but there's a lot of visible signs that could be possibly showing some type of, causing some type of impairment, and that drug recognition expert will come out and do an evaluation, because at the end of the day, we have to be able to articulate in court what that person's impairment visible signs were and what those physical patterns or responses are that align with saying they are under the influence of marijuana or under this prescription drug or whatever that may be. So moving forward, sorry, this is a lot, I don't think that process is really going to change much. We don't know if we're going to see an influx of people who are driving behind the wheel impaired, because honestly, when it comes down to impaired driving, it's really a people's choice thing. And we see, I think, years where we have less drunk drivers and less fatalities, and then we see years where it spikes greatly. And it's really up to your community to set the tone of how they want their streets to be and how safe they want their streets to be. And unfortunately, you know, the police department, we try to be as proactive about that as much as we can. But sometimes we get there usually when it's too late. And so it kind of takes more of a responsibility or an effort on the consumer's part to say, I'm not going to get behind the wheel impaired. And that's what we're really hoping people do with this as of February 24th, is that if they consume a marijuana and they know that it's going to impair or inhibit their ability to drive safely, just to make that choice as they would with alcohol, to not get behind the wheel.
But as far as the department goes and as far as advocacy goes, is there anything, are you guys supporting a zero tolerance policy of if you smoke, just please don't drive, if you are high, just don't drive, or is there any kind of threshold that you guys know of or are looking at?
From a legal perspective, like in the scenario where somebody gets pulled over and there's, a field test on and then blood test on and so forth, that gets into a whole legal realm that, we could spend an hour on just that. and I'm hoping that over the next year or two, with more research being done nationally, we'll have some better metrics to go by in that scenario. I would say right now, just as I would with alcohol, I'd say, look, if you're going to indulge, do it responsibly, do it in moderation, or have a designated driver. I would make that suggestion to a friend who was going to drink alcohol or consume marijuana. It's a totally appropriate perspective. And if people are going to celebrate on Tuesday, great, do that. If you're not doing it at home, then just have a plan for getting home safely.
Yeah, and that's kind of always our message as well from the police department is have a plan before you get into it, because obviously once you start consuming alcohol and the more you consume alcohol, you're going to lose that ability to make good judgment calls. Sure. And so, I think you can say, similar marijuana to alcohol, just treat it as the same as your limits, how your body responds to these things. And I think everybody kind of has their own little pinpoint of when they know I'm no longer going to be able to drive safely. And so just have a plan ahead of time if you have a certain celebration or that you're going to be consuming at a certain point and say, okay, this is my plan for getting home safely or getting to A, point A to B, safely.
Stepping back just for a second away from the kind of nitty-gritty of this, this is not full legalization because there's really still no legal mechanism for sales. Right. And Mr. Schulte, I'm curious to hear from you, in the year ahead, is this just an extension of Raven where marijuana magically is appearing or getting to people? And then two, I'm curious about how intermunicipal exchange will happen. Is that something that APD, will you guys be expending effort seeing product move in from the valley or going out to the bush, or is that really the purview of the troopers? So Mr. Schulte, let's start with you on the question of
There's a couple of different components to that. I would say, Raven was sort of a tacit acknowledgement of an individual's right to privacy. Not tacit, actually, it was a codified acknowledgement of that right to privacy in one's home. So this is different. After February 24th, one can legitimately drive from here to the valley with up to an ounce of marijuana in their possession. They could have six immature plants in their car. They could be driving out to the valley to gift those to a friend. So to that extent, I think the marijuana magically appearing sort of goes away because somebody could say, well, I would like to try growing a marijuana plant, and I have a friend who has one. So they could legitimately give them a cloned plant and it's a totally lawful activity. So that's different, and I'm not aware of any stipulation that can't be done across municipal boundaries. I'm pretty sure I could drive somebody could drive from Anchorage to Kenai and bring an ounce of marijuana and give it to a friend.
As long as those municipalities haven't elected to not have it in their community kind of thing.
Yes and no, because the local option component of ballot measure 2 really addresses the commercial side, the growing, processing, and selling of marijuana. It doesn't really address personal possession. My understanding is that personal possession up to 1 ounce is pretty much across the board. Now, there may be local municipalities still have a degree of autonomy, so they may step beyond that. But I'm not sure that somebody, a municipality, could say, "Well, we're gonna change that possession amount from 1 ounce down to a half an ounce or a quarter of an ounce." I'm not sure if legally they can do that.
My understanding is it's still an open question that SB 30 is trying to deal with as far as adapting local option laws onto grafting it against the Raven Raven decision. And if I remember correctly, one of the early hearings, Senator Liesl McGuire, Republican from Anchorage, had said we can legally do everything up to outlawing possession in the home. And I say all this mostly to just throw out, I don't think anybody has a lot of clear legal certainty yet on how a lot of this is gonna adapt. But I do, Ms. Castro, wanna give you the chance to kind of say anything you might know about how the Anchorage police will be responding to product moving around the state, or out of Anchorage, I should say, whether it's in supplies larger than an ounce or out. And really getting out, I'm thinking of freight by air or potentially by ship. But is that something that's on your guys' radar?
It's always been on our radar. Like, this has already been happening in Anchorage and in other areas for a long time, where we work with corresponding law enforcement agencies, whether it's the U.S. Marshals or troopers or whoever. And if we have cases where we know somehow Anchorage is involved, whether it's the physical product that's here or the people that are involved with it, we're always working with those agencies to move a case forward, whether it becomes fully our case or their case. We might just be the assist with that. And so we've always been engaged with that. I know a lot of the times we do have, and especially, in recent years with some of our more limited staffing numbers, we have been particularly focused on the bigger suppliers, the bigger dealers, where we know that if you take them out of the focus, then it will trickle down and have that larger impact. And so we've kind of, especially in the recent years, been focused on the larger operations and the movement of that between Anchorage and other places and cities. I think, a lot of the things that we found, we've even worked with some of the local hotels, where we know that people come up here from California, from Mexico, from other places, and they kind of have a transplant here where their job is just to accept packages at that hotel, and it's drugs. A lot of the times it's other drugs such as heroin or things like that. And we work, to figure out who the players are, and sometimes that makes us have to go work with other law enforcement agencies such as California, where we know that product is originating from. So that's kind of something that's already been in existence. Moving forward, obviously, it just depends on what kind of laws are created. I know one of the big questions that we originally had was, can you take marijuana? Obviously, Alaska's almost, it's not an island, obviously, but we're not connected to the lower 48. And so other states, can you take it from one legal state to another legal state? But you still have this fly zone, so even though Washington, for instance, is very close to Alaska, can you fly something down to Washington? From what we understand at this point in time, you can't. There isn't that exchange of possession. But in terms of interstate and what you can do interstate, I think a lot of that is still being addressed and getting defined in that way. And really our interest, our focus is kind of on the bigger product, not someone's personal possession in their home. And that's how it's always been. Mm-hmm. I don't know if people have kind of a misperception of that, but we've never really been about going after that individual who's doing something in the privacy of our home. It's more on a larger scale, usually, where it's potentially affecting a lot of people. And usually there's a lot of other crimes that are being involved in that situation, such as weapons crimes and assaults and other things that are happening as a result of that activity.
Thank you. Yeah. A lot of moving parts, and yeah. I hate to say it, but we've run out of time for today's discussion on the pending legalization of marijuana and what it means this Tuesday for Alaskans. Let's quickly turn to a big story from earlier this week when Interior Secretary Sally Jewell visited Kotzebue to attend an AFN retreat and visit Kivalina to talk with residents about the impacts of climate change in their community. State lawmakers and the congressional delegation that went along were there in Kotzebue to talk with Jewell in person about their frustration with the administration's plans for the Arctic. Alaska Public Media reporter Alexander Gutierrez and videographer Eric Quito have the story on the trip to the Northwest Arctic community of Kotzebue.
The meeting location was kept secret from the public, so secret that Sally Jewell herself reportedly was delayed half an hour. Once the Interior Secretary arrived, a team made of 9 legislators and North Slope Borough Mayor Charlotte Brower proceeded to air their grievances over how the Obama administration is managing Alaska.
We just want to have a voice in decisions that are going to be made for Alaska. We don't want to be subjects of the United States. We want to be citizens of the United States.
Senator Mike Dunleavy, a MATSU Republican who previously lived in Kotzebue, described the conversation as polite, but said nothing was really accomplished and that Alaska lawmakers might have better luck dealing with the state's congressional delegation.
We're kind of spinning our wheels talking about this stuff. And again, I think I think we have to have a discussion with our delegation.
Over the course of the press conference, legislators stressed the importance of developing more oil in the state because most of Alaska's tax revenue comes from its production.
We just want the federal government to let us develop our resources.
The federal overreach is really impeding our opportunities to contribute not only to the Alaskan economy, but to the American economy.
House Majority Leader Charisse Millett confronted Jewel about so-called legacy wells that were drilled by the federal government but never cleaned up.
Frankly, if she cares about the environment, she'd be cleaning up the legacy wells. I understand that she wants to hit the reset button. She said it several times. Hitting the reset button with Alaskans would mean that she would have to, and the federal government would have to, sit down and listen to us, not just come up and give us platitudes and pat us on the head.
At a press conference held outside, Jewel said she understood the state's economic position.
I think that there is a lot of pain being felt in Alaska because of oil prices. I may be an easy target, but the reality is oil prices have fallen dramatically, and that's impacted the state's budget. I do think oil prices will bounce back. I do think that this is a shorter-term phenomenon.
And in the long term,
the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is not going to solve dependence of a state on a commodity price.
The proposal to designate 12 million acres of Arctic Refuge land as wilderness would have to be approved by Congress, unless the president takes an executive action and treats the land as a monument under the Antiquities Act.
We have no plans to exercise the Antiquities Act.
She was firm on the administration's position on the refuge.
We believe the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is one of the most intact ecosystems in the world, and we think keeping it that way is very important. We do know that oil and gas development has impacts. It has impacts on wildlife, it has impacts on water quality and air quality, and we believe that the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is too special to develop.
Jewel added that she hopes to see better cooperation between the state and federal governments in the future, and that in her meeting with legislators, she suggested creating a task force to improve communication. In Kotzebue, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
That's all the time we have this week on Alaska Edition. Thanks to both of my guests, Jennifer Castro of the Anchorage Police Department and Bruce Schulte of the Coalition for Responsible Cannabis Legislation. And thank you for joining us at home. I'm Zachariah Hughes.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.